For those of you hanging out with us today, I'd like you to meet Miss Catherine Burns. Kat is a two-time Emmy-winning choreographer, actress, dancer, director, and coach. She has choreographed over 200 TV shows, many including shows like Crazy Ex-Girlfriends, which she won an Emmy for, The Simpsons, The Morning Show, Key and Peele, Reno 911, Dancing with the Stars, Why Women Kill, Drunk History, and so many more. She's also worked with numerous artists, including Pharrell Williams on his Grammy Award-winning music video for Happy, Logic, Taboo from the Black Eyed Peas, Weird Al Yankovic, he's one of my favorite, and many others. And it even says on her website that she once cried on a couch while Bruno Mars fed her ice cream for his Funny or Die video.
Kick back, pour yourself a nice dram of whiskey, and let's settle you in for some low-key conversations on high-performance living. This is Wise Words in Whiskey.
Now, her bio is chock full of other amazing accomplishments and success, but I did not bring her here today to discuss that. I have Kat with me on the show today to talk about dancing, dogs, and death, and how that actually correlates with our life experiences. Kat, it's really good that we finally were able to do this. I'm really happy to have you here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course.
Dancing, dogs, and death.
It's a little bit of a shock, yes, but you know what? I think it's so relevant given how we even met, and I'm looking forward to diving into the conversation, sharing those three different points, how they can relate to life, and how people can start to shift their mindset towards all three of them, and why they're important, because there's so many different ways in which we can utilize those wise words that come from those aspects of living. So before we get into that, we have a very special bottle of whiskey I want us to crack open and pour ourselves a little bit of a drink here. And if you're in the audience, this is the dancing, let me just turn it that way. Dancing Daughters. There we go. Kat, what's great is this is a woman-owned and operated craft whiskey distillery out of Spring Valley, California. And it's unique because, number one, Dancing Daughters, given you're a dancer as well, but I want to read this for you in the audience real quick before we take our taste. They have on their website, whiskey isn't just a man's drink. So why is it often made by men for men? Dancing Daughters wants to shake things up. Every bottle of their lemon-flavored whiskey is produced by their female-owned and operated craft whiskey company in California. Yes. No more masculine branding. No more manly bottles, which made me chuckle. Just the best American whiskey made with you in mind. Now, about these two co-founders, Dancing and Daughters Fine Whiskey is the original whiskey created by Kelly and Jessica. They wanted to create a unique whiskey that evokes the 1920s glamour, sophistication, and just a little 1920s speakeasy spirit. The Dancing Daughters, Kat, were the nicknames given to the fierce and unapologetic women of the 1920s who unapologetically challenged societal norms. And through the passage of the 19th Amendment, finally giving women the right to vote, women's rights were still limited. The Dancing Daughters, though rejected those limitations, they entered the workforce, drove cars, and attended jazz clubs by night. So, why powerful women? It's because they know inside each Dancing Daughters drinker is a strong, independent woman who loves her whiskey just as much as the men do. This is all about their spirit, embracing that fighting spirit of women from the 1920s, but it represents that sophistication, that era of speakeasy, the dancing aspect of life. So
that's so cool. It's so perfect. What a good find. Nice. I also didn't know I guess you consider them like what, abolitionists, or like, I didn't realize that was a term, Dancing Daughters, for the 1920s, for the women.
I didn't either. And that's why I was excited to have them, you know, provide these bottles for us today and talk about their craft and their mission, because it's a smaller distillery, but you know, it was important to highlight them as well, especially given the conversation at hand. And I learned quite a bit, you know, reading about the Dancing Daughters and what it really means. Now, this is a lemon-flavored whiskey, which I think would be a fantastic summer drink if you wanted to add, like, ginger beer, ice, a little, whatever other favorite flavor that can go along with it. But right now, what we're going to do is taste this neat, Kat. Or you can put ice.
Right as you said it, I was like, you said
it's ice. Okay. You know what? You did that, and I'm glad you did it. You can go ahead and tell us. Whiskey experiences start with the nose. And when you start with the nose, you basically are allowing your senses to kind of experience the juice, if you will, before you sip it. It's almost like a nice activation of memory. So I want to start there with that. Of course, you get the lemon.
It's almost lemongrassy. which is nice.
And is you know what? I really get behind it though. Ooh, it's a lemongrassy, but I also get like these subtle notes of like soft summer fruit almost on the back end of it. It's it kind of follows the lemon. It's not, once you give yourself a little bit of a smell a couple times, you start to, I'm getting at least.
Does it do anything putting your nose on the whole bottle?
No. So whiskey experiences like this are all about opening up the whiskey itself, or the spirit, allowing the aromas to breathe. And then when you allow your nose to smell it, you can experience different types. Now, from that smell, we're going to go into tasting it. And before we do, what we have is a typical toast. We say cheers in America, but in Gaelic, in Scotland and Ireland, we say to your health by the word sláinte. So I want to toast to your health. Give ourselves just a little bit of a taste, Kat. Put a little on your tongue, let it sit for a second, and then swallow it.
Like Catholic Mass.
Absolutely.
Yummy.
Wow. At 70 proof, it's a little bit lighter.
What's normal?
Alcohol by volume. What are you experiencing?
Well, it's really light. It's really lovely. Like, I feel like the few times I've had whiskey has been more caramely, I guess, or like,
yeah,
but like a deeper, like this definitely feels like you would, like I said, when I was snowed in and drinking whiskey was a very different thing, like for warmth. And this definitely feels like a nice summer version of it.
Yeah, I can see adding, like I said earlier, I think they have it even on their website. Ginger beer is like a go-to.
Oh, yeah.
Nice ginger beer added to this with some ice would be quite the summer drink. And I think I might have to try that out, you know, next time I'm barbecuing in the backyard. But
it's like a Moscow Mule is what, gin? Or
yeah, I think so. I think you do. Yeah, Moscow Mule is gin. But for me, just to have the experience with a new whiskey like this is the first time I've ever had it as well. I got to give them credit. It is very smooth. It is easy on the palate. It is not overwhelming. And you don't get that really cringy burn in the back of your throat with some whiskeys that do that to you. And I know people that are listening might go, I hate whiskey because I don't like the burn. But this is an opportunity for them to try something a little bit less intense for the palate. And maybe that can help introduce them to why we create whiskeys so differently, you know, with different distilleries and different casks. The last thought I have for you on this is whiskey itself, why we do it this way, why distillers make such a unique stink about their craft is because it's not about getting drunk. It truly is about slowing down, sophistication, grounding yourself, getting back to appreciation for the finer things in life, and learning how to value something so quality-esque instead of just drinking to get drunk. Because if the whole point was just to get inebriated, we would just have one type of whiskey, it would be flavored, and everybody would buy it. But without further ado, I want to jump into this conversation here, speaking of that aspect. Dancing Dogs and Death, and how that actually relates to life specifically. Now, you and I met in Sedona, Arizona, on a mountaintop. I saw you with your two. You have a German Shepherd and a Malinois, or both Malinois? I don't
know. Well, they're rescues, and right. Stop me if I'm talking too much about the dog parts of Dancing Dogs and Death. I might try to avoid the latter.
I'll
double D's. But yeah. So I was just fostering because I had a few weeks off work and I was like, I've never had dogs. Let's see how this goes. My cats had died and I like couldn't even bear looking at a cat without crying. So I was just fostering and they were like, do you want these 7, these 5, or these 2? And I was like, well, 2 seems plenty. My house is small. And then I kept them both because, you know, YOLO, one of them was like sensitive and the other was a more of a sheriff type.
Right.
They're laying on the floor here, which is why I keep looking over. And then maybe I'll zoom over and show you. But anyways, I got the backstory is important because then when I got the DNA back after I had already adopted them, I found out that they were, because I thought they were like a street mutt, like they were abandoned in the streets of LA, found at a restaurant parking lot, the whole litter of 9, and then redlined at a kill shelter. And so I thought they'd be a mix of things, part Chihuahua, like most of the dogs in LA. And then to find out they were half German Shepherd, half Belgian Malinois, like perfectly evenly split. But one looks exactly, the little one looks exactly little. He's like 65 pounds. And on cue. Okay, boys, leave it. Good question. So they're good dogs. And if we're ready for war, apparently I'm ready as well. But yeah, so one's more Malinois looking and activity and personality, and the other is more Shepherd.
They are indeed working dogs and have the personality, and they're definitely confirming what you're talking about, Mom, for sure. But dog or Dancy, and I want to start there because we met with you on the mountaintop with your dogs, which is what connected us. And then we just started talking about, number one, I want to just say before we jump into it, that you have absolute, I would say, profound confidence when you walk your dogs off leash. It is a level of, yes, discipline that I noticed in you when I saw you, that most people don't have when it comes to disciplining themselves, their animals, their children, and so forth. So I thought that was very fascinating because it's definitely a virtue that needs to be brought back to society, is learning how to command yourself so that you can create discipline and actually experience a little bit more latitude in the things that you would otherwise leash up, if you will.
Oh,
but the dancing, you and I sat on the mountain and started talking about what we both do for a living, and you shared with me your backstory, which is what, how I introduced you, how dancing itself has lost its magic, how it's lost its appeal, how it has been perverted in society. You started out with, you know, improv, and you found yourself more driven by story-lined choreography and dance that has more of that levity and comedy and you know, appreciation to it. I think that's doing the best I can to describe what I've understood about your backstory and how, what got you started into dance. So I'm going to start there with you on dancing and how people need to get back into it, but from the right reasons, because I think we have what our culture is all about, humping and grinding each other nowadays, and everything is sexualized and completely erratic, and it's no longer seen as this beautiful, elegant art and expression of the self. And you are all about that, which is why you've been so successful. So I want to share with, first of all, the audience and talk about dancing and why it's so special and why we need to start pushing people to build more, you know, venues for us to go get back to dancing, like the 1920s, you know, mm-hmm. talking about whiskey, et cetera. What are your thoughts around that aspect of dancing that we've lost?
Yeah, well, I mean, first off, very serendipitous to be on top of, I don't remember which vortex it was called, but media on top of vortex, yeah. And I was very in my head about, that was the dog's first off-leash hike that wasn't in California. So it was a new environment, and I was, you know, they were probably like 7 months or 9 months.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was nervous, and I really appreciated your vote of confidence, because I think people mostly like look at me and they go, what is wrong with that woman? What has she done with her life and herself? And also because they're so intimidating looking that there's, you know, I have to keep them in check. It's dangerous if you don't, even little dogs, you know?
Of course. Yeah.
I take the art of raising two giant dogs.
You are, just real quick, and I'm going to plug this right now. That's what makes you so successful in dance, because you have that kind of command that you hold as a choreographer. You have to be able to command the people you're leading and teaching. You have to be able to direct. You're a director, an actress yourself. I mean, you have to know and embody that level of discipline and confidence so that you can produce those results of that type of free form expression, which translates in parlays into like how you raise your dog. So that's why I started with the dance aspect, and we can lean into the dogs because they do correlate with one another.
Definitely. Yeah. All my like actor friends are like, wait, this is crazy that you're doing this, but wait, it's actually so perfect for you. Like a choreographing your two dogs. Like it's all you and that's it. Stay. Like you can do it verbally or non-verbally. And then what I've learned with them is also reflection on the things I want to work on in my life and in just in creative rooms and creative spaces, is that you have to be clear and calm. And, you know, there's no emotion tied to a command. Like sit, stay, it has to just be definitive and clear. And you don't repeat yourself, because then they learn, like on the third sit is when they really sit. And if you're, I could talk literally for hours about just the things I've learned about dogs. Keep in mind, I didn't even grow up with dogs, so this was all brand new, but I understand movement and then being an alpha, like, you know, chest high, even how you stand, even you could give a command, but how you say it makes all the difference. The follow through, the repetition, that is obviously very dance driven and very similar. I mean, I always, like when I was dancing and like auditioning for stuff, I was like casting the dancers in the room and like picturing who would book the job, but like not include myself in it. So dance and discipline for me is kind of different, but I've always, like, in the sense of like, I felt like I don't have the discipline of these dancers, because I've always wanted to like know the why of it all. Like I call it like dancing for dance sake. Like I don't know. That's a whole other tangent. But
well, that's fine. Real quick, let me stop you there because I'm curious. There's a couple things that you said that I want to point out. Number one was the there is no emotion in your commands. I think that's a piece right. that most people lose. We blend it in our world today. People think that commanding someone with anger and frustration behind it is being confident and in charge. In reality, is nobody wants to follow a leader that acts that way through emotion. That's one huge component of it. I think those are really good wise words for people to listen to right now. Is are you leading and commanding with emotion, or are you doing it just from a place of confidence and clarity and understanding? That changes the way in which something like a dog or even other human beings follow you. The other thing is I wanted to ask you, and maybe you can expand on, is what actually inspired you or turned you on or pulled you into wanting to know all about different types of movement, and that led you into where you're at right now, because you're very eloquent at it. You're very good at what you do. And that's clearly evident in my ability to see you from a distance, even with your two new dogs, not knowing. I could have swore you were a dog owner for your entire life, the way you held them in command. So what got you into dance?
I have been stopped sometime to ask recently. Somebody asked me for my card, and I was like, sorry, what? Like, are you a trainer? I was like, no, they're just giant dogs. And I have to get in front of them.
I know exactly what I need to do. Yeah. But what got you into it? What inspired you to step in towards that, you know, story-driven movement?
Towards dance? You know what? To be honest, and I'm sorry I didn't answer your question earlier. I'll answer to the end of this one. But I've always loved it. Like, I think, like, I was moving the second I was born for the most part. And moved by song. I don't know. I just was always moving around. Like, my family would joke that they would give me, like, a ribbon in a hallway, and I'd be just going off doing cartwheels and leaps. And anytime there was something movement driven, I studied it. I loved to watch old movie musicals with my dad. We like watched all the Shirley Temples, and then like when Blockbuster was a thing, we like watched musicals and sports guy. And so that was like a thing. And we would just every day rent a different musical. And my older siblings were like so annoyed that I was watching all these like 1950s musicals and not really knowing the words, but like pretending like I did. And I would always like put on Welcome Home shows, because before the internet and before cell phones, there was nothing else to do but like look at each other. And so my siblings would like come back from camp, and I would put on like a Welcome Home show, which they're like, great, thanks.
Here goes Cat again. Yep. Okay. So you were innately born with it. It was just a part of you coming out of the womb, and it led you into it, which I think is part of what your fabric that makes you so, I would say, in tune with your ability to naturally lead others in movement.
Yeah, there was a curiosity, most definitely. And I do think, like, it is really interesting. There is something, and maybe this is misguided, and maybe people want to make money, and so then they go away from this. But I do think, like, around when kids are 5 years old, you can really see, at least I feel like I can see with my nieces and nephews, like, what they're naturally really good at. And a lot of people that I've come in contact with in LA, which obviously lots of people do lots of different things, is if they like listen to their purest interest and their own heart that they're able to do it as a living when they're older, it becomes pretty magical, because it is authentic. And then by default, their whole life they've been studying this thing and perfecting what it is they're interested at, because all they're doing is acquiring information. Versus like getting a trade degree and you're like, you go to school for 2 years and then you get the thing and you can do the thing.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to land another point. I think what it is that people that are missing out on is, are they doing things based on what actually is something that they're passionate about? What is in their heart? What they truly are feeling called to? Or are they just doing it because of what is expected of them, or what, you know, dad or mom may have done before them? I know there are some people that follow in the footsteps of their parents.
Right.
But I think that what you said is important for people to hear, that it's all about truly what drives you in your heart, not in your head. And I think I've had conversations with people in LA, even some of the work that I've done over the last 14 years. I've worked with different public figures, and we've had conversations where they've recognized I've been doing what I've been doing based on what I thought I was supposed to do, rather than on what is really in my heart, what is really passionate about what it is that I really want to do. And I think that is where people end up getting stuck when they get older.
Yeah. Or even just this a natural inclination towards a thing. Like, I'm listening to Molly Shannon's book right now, and I would say reading it, but let's be honest, it's in my ear. If I can, like, you know, run errands and read.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm really avid reader. That was in quotes if you're listening on the pod.
Yeah, you're listening on audio. Yeah.
But she's talking about her childhood and how imagination, and there was like this rebellious aspect and kind of rule-breaking aspect that her father had, and he was a bit of a misfit, and she was, and overcame some really tough things in life by playing. And even like, you know, with telemarketers, her dad would have to answer it, and then he was like, that wasn't believable, do it again. And so she always had this sense of imagination and play that then when she got older, like, were characters for SNL. And so,
right,
you know, that means acting, you know, it's easier to point back into things. And obviously having the luxury to do what you love for a living is definitely coming from a place of privilege. But it does come with enormous sacrifice of leaving your family, being very broke, having to strike for your rights, you know, or starting to guilt. Well, because you don't have
those sacrifices. Those sacrifices are, those are the good, those are the necessary sacrifices sometimes, I think, to go after something you're mission oriented around. I think that's right. The other piece of it is too, is we all have our place and we all have our own level of capacity and we all have something that we're meant to be doing. I think finding mm-hmm. out what that is requires a deeper self-reflection and ability to slow down your mind and emotions and really connect to what's in your heart and actually discovering, like, is it worth me sacrificing certain things that are necessary? Like, you know, maybe being away from home for a little while, suffering through being broke because I'm so connected to that mission, or am I just doing it for the hopes that maybe I might make a bunch of money and have some popularity down the road? And I think that's what separates people like you from those that tend to struggle and stay caught in the grind. Or for people that are listening, there are business owners and athletes and things that listen. It's like, take that with you, where look at the fruits of your movement. Mm-hmm. Are your fruits producing deep satisfaction, regardless if you're making the money right now or you're feeling like things are really going as well as you want them to? What is really pulling you along? And I think that's what you just mentioned, was I was willing to sacrifice and embrace not having certain things because I cared so much about the movement, so much about dance.
Let's also be honest. I got fired from all the other jobs, okay? I wasn't very good at regular jobs. Okay? Let's not act like I figured it out and I'm some idiot. I definitely tried. I went to college to be a nurse. I worked in post-production for years and thought I wanted to be an editor. But when anyone was like, what's your dream job? I was like, well, to choreograph for TV and film, but there's no school for that. I don't know how to do it. It's just like backup dancers that then tour the world with Janet Jackson and then become choreographers. Like, I don't know. But anyways, but I did want to talk, and you know, in being at home now and being with my parents, I do applaud them for being supportive and, you know, in the beginning, definitely crying every time I went to the airport, but still understanding that it was authentic to me and letting me, you know, live my life and not a recreation of anyone else's. But back to the social dancing and everyone dancing, what I think is so interesting, specifically in comedy, everyone's like, wait, you do comedy and dance? I'm like, yeah, I mean, that was vaudeville. Everyone's like, that, no one does that. I'm like, well, that is vaudeville. And burlesque was story driven and funny. It wasn't just nudity at all. Like, if so, it was even just like a small version of it. But I think dancing started off, I mean, obviously separate of that, there's actually a lot to go into it, but there's a social aspect to it that brings people together, and it's a common unspoken language, and it brings community and it brings ritual. I mean, even if you think about, I was thinking recently about, I choreographed something that had a religious tone, and the thought of the performer was that they wanted to be still and not move like the music to me had spoke, because they thought it was reverent and it was an internal moment. And then I was thinking about religion and denominations, and there's like the whirling dervishes. If you're Muslim, there's always a bit of a movement, and there's like a praying of the hour, or even that, like, Catholic stand up, sit down, fight, 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 how you're always kneeling. If you go to like
sacraments,
church, right? That's like, you know, not to be, you know, racial or.
Yeah,
but like, you know, black church, it's much different than white church, and like the way we move as a society and the way we move in different cultures.
Baptist churches in the South versus the, you know, the Catholic churches in the West. I completely understand. And there's different rituals and different ways in which we express in our sacraments and how we, you know, worship our movement.
Right. And it is, as I've learned, it's just interesting to see, you know, beyond Christianity too, like what worship looks like. And sometimes it is really physical and sometimes it is really still. And then, and even beyond that, like being in LA and knowing lots of different people, like a lot of the dancers I'm able to hire have had dance in every family gathering, you know, they're dancing family, and I see pictures of their moms and dads and they're dancing and having parties all the time. and it's so much a part of their culture. I mean, I was raised Irish Catholic, so it's not here and in Texas, so it's not necessarily. But then if you learn, I learned about oh my gosh, Irish tap dancing.
You're talking about river dancing.
River dancing, yes. But apparently, this could be an old wives' tale, but apparently, dancing was outlawed in Ireland, Scotland. I'm probably messing this up. Please look at the internet and then tell me all of.
No, there was something around that. Yeah, I grew up in an Irish Scottish household. My grandparents were immigrants, so I get it.
Okay, so tell me if I'm wrong. So police would go past the houses and people would dance, but only with their bottom half, so that the police couldn't tell they were dancing. Is that true?
It's an underground form of expression when they had, religious, you know. Yep. Say again.
It's so interesting. I think that's so interesting that like people look at it as like pretty basic, but like it's rooted in story. And the reason why they dance with their bottom half is because out dancing was outlawed.
Well, you think about it, there was quite a bit of religious persecution on both sides over in Ireland and in Scotland, of course, with the crown and everything going on with, you know, the fight for liberty in those areas. There's so much that you could and couldn't do, and they saw dance and different things as an expression of freedom. So there was ways in which they could oppress them. Now, I don't know 100% of the story either, but I do remember hearing things from my Nana, who was from Glasgow, Scotland, and I remember talking to my grandfather. They were around. His family's from around Limerick, Ireland. So learning about the different ways in which these cultures operated in dance was an expression of freedom, which is what you are all about, is expressing yourself in full freedom and getting people to know how that benefits your life. And it's not actually a bad thing.
And I do think like, and you know, obviously I'm around a lot of like creative misfits in a great way in my circle and they're comedians and they're storytellers and writers. And there's a sense of play and freedom that we are granted with our work as adults, but the older we get, the less we move and the less freedom, like we have to walk. Like if I was walking down the street, like I did when I was 4 years old, people probably thought I escaped from somewhere, you know? I want to, but like I held myself back. And I think it's interesting that like as dancers often sit on the floor, like even on set, you know, production, like we're supposed to have chairs and breaks and things, but you'll find dancers just like sitting and on the floor and stretching and creative freedom in the world, like the stand up, sit down, like we're quite linear as adults with what we can and can't do. And even with the way we are with dogs, we want them to fit into our world and behave in a certain linear way so that they're not running.
Well, I'm glad you transitioned that right now, because I was thinking about it, where you brought your level of understanding of movement, story-driven movement, and how dynamic and how flow that really is, and how you translate that into your leadership as a mom for dogs. And this is what a good point we can talk about, because people want to control everything. They want it to, because they might feel anxiety if their dog is doing something that seems inappropriate or might make other people uncomfortable. There's no confidence in the discipline of realizing that animal wants you to be confident, so it knows who the leader is. Parlaying that movement and that confidence and movement into raising animals, raising dogs, and why people need to get back to using that form of discipline and movement for a better experience with children themselves and their animals. So going to like being a new mom, taking what you did as a dancer, you parlayed it, even though you didn't, like, I didn't know what I was doing, I just got these dogs and I'm just going to go with what I know. And that's clearly working really well, which is why I saw from a distance, I thought, man, she's got those dogs under control. This is amazing. I can't wait. I hope she comes up here, because I want to meet her, because I do the same thing with my dog.
From my parents that are listening.
Well, what was that?
Can you say that a little louder from my parents that are listening?
I was highly impressed with Kat. I will say that. She's got things well under control in a very good way, and I think people need to learn how to do that for themselves, too.
It is one of her big dogs.
Yeah, Bruce, come say hi to my dad. Bruce,
come say hi.
Oh.
Howdy, sir.
But there is also, I mean, it is a learning curve in the sense of, like, yes, there's getting them under control, but there's also a freedom in learning what they're built to do and what they're meant to do, and like picking your battles of like, well, that's why I did the DNA, so I could have a more educated process to how I train them and what battles I can and cannot win. Like their guard dog, they're gonna bark. Yep. They're gonna have a loud bark and they're doing their job. And then, you know, how do I operate within those parameters?
Let me, one thought, I'm going to stop again here, Kat, for a second, because it's important, I think, for the audience to hear that, is doing your due diligence and understanding your responsibilities and what it is that you are taking on in life. I think too many people have children without being kind of somewhat prepared. I know you can never be fully prepared for kids, but there is a level of understanding, you know, again, are you ready for it? What are the ins and outs, the cons and the pros for having a child, who we are in our life and our successes, where we should be and how it's going to affect our ability to raise them the way that we feel is appropriate. Now, raising dogs is the same way. You did your due diligence by learning their bloodline, so you can do some more research to know what level of movement and confidence should I possess that matches the capacity of these animals so that I can have a very fulfilled, free, and very healthy life. Because by doing so, I give them the latitude and the luxury of being a little bit more free rather than being the human that has to control all of their movements linear, left, right, up, down, back, forth. I give them enough of that containment to experience life a little bit differently. And dogs would love that. Children would love that. We want that. But I think we're too rigid in our approach to taking on dogs and children and ourselves. I think we need to bring that kind of discipline back into our lives as well.
And what I learned from the trainer is that, I mean, I had a few different trainers, but one of them trained my dog, Bernie, was also very creative, like with learning with heel and walking, that it's important to give them yes and no and tell them when they're doing something right and to keep them at a heel, but then also to give them breaks and let them dog. You know what I mean? Like let them dog sometimes even, and then come back to the training and then release. And then it is, you know, with as a choreographer and with animals, it's a little different because I don't like feed the dancers as I'm choreographing them. But obviously, like feeding the dog, like do it good and you will get lunch. Do it again, you will get it right. No, I'm not that. Wish I were not. I'm not
little,
that type.
Little incentives never hurt, but I get it. I think the incentives
I was going to say, because we were having a training session through the Choreographers Guild of a DEIA in how to kind of course correct some bad behaviors of choreographers that are like mirroring people in leadership positions that are kind of are operating from a place of disparity and like they don't have a lot, and so they're taking without, I don't know how to describe that. There's a better word for this, but you know what I'm talking about, right?
I do. Yeah, I do.
What's it called? Disparity? Well, there's not a lot of something. The word's escaping me.
Well, the disparity aspect of it is like they are lacking and they are feeling that lack. So the semantics of it are slipping me as well. But what I will say is I understand that, because in a leadership position where people are lacking themselves are going to not lead from a place of fulfillment, and they're not going to give people, again, they're not going to give them the right kind of environment or containment that allows them to step up and actually perform at their best as well. And I see that time and time again, working behind the scenes with certain types of powerful people that have unfortunately built their levels of business success on their own disparity, on their own lack. And their people are suffering as a result, even though they might be doing well from a monetary standpoint or a bottom line, you know, P&L balance sheet point of view. But the reality is their performance is not as optimal as it could be should you have a leader, like you're saying, that is standing there fulfilled and coming from a place of that clarity and confidence.
Well, thank you. That's what I was going for.
No problem.
P&L, I was like, P&L, profit and loss, maybe. I don't know. Yes. Spreadsheets. Okay.
you can parlay that into anything. It really comes down to basically your performance. People call them KPIs, but for me as a human performance guy, it's all about truly the person's capacity to perform when they're given the right environment and discipline, incentive. Yeah, right. The leader like you that would stand in front of the dancers and allowing them to make the mistakes, correcting them, but awarding them when they need to, and really giving them the space to move and flow with you.
Well, I was going to say that the correlation with dogs and dancing is obviously with dogs, they trust you because you feed them, or they at least want to trust you. You are the person that supplies things for them by food. And so there's an innate trust that, you know, that you can break, obviously, and then the dog will retaliate, whether to you or other people. But I think the important thing with power is you have to have trust. And without the two, there's an imbalance, right? Like someone can have power but not be trusted. And you can't have power in a vacuum, right? Like if I lived in a vortex and nobody was around me, and I'm just yelling, like, who am I in power? What does power mean when you're by yourself? And right. when people or money isn't in play, what are you in power of? So to me, power only exists if there's trust with that.
I like that. Then, let's let that sit for a second. Power only exists when there's trust. See, especially in today's political landscape and all the leaders that we, and I use air quotes myself for those that are listening, the leadership that's out there, I think it's kind of a joke to say that nowadays because they're not performing from a place of trust, but they have this absolute power they're utilizing, trying to control or leash up people. You know, we're using the dog analogy.
Right.
Again, going back to what you said earlier, is that we want them to be a certain way and to do a certain thing, and we're not giving enough trust for people, for dogs, for kids to move through life differently so that we can then correct and associate new levels of performance and growth for that individual or that animal. So our leaders are unfortunately doing the same thing. And power itself is not the defining terms of success. I look at, I think I said it the other day to someone, was leadership is not about how great you are. It's about making others around you better. Mm. And when you have that kind of confidence, when you're taking care of your employees, your staff, your dancers, your dogs, your children, right. yourself, it really comes down to yourself. Do you do that for yourself first? Do you live your life by the way in which you lead your others and your animals? And I think there are a lot of people that are in these positions that are suffering, and they're suffering and they're doing things that go against what that natural inclination is that you just talked about. And it's causing more problems than it is good. And then they're trying to command through the emotion that they're feeling because they're lacking and they're in that disparity.
And I wonder too, with like, I don't know, I kind of realized this on a set recently, is people are getting a lot of power and money in a vacuum when it comes to social media. So someone can have a massive following, let's say as a choreographer or as a creative or as a director or insert whatever creative leadership position, through the what they're able to curate on their page on by themselves, kind of right. in a vacuum. And then when you put them into like what we consider a more real life environment, which is like, how do you lead a set? What do you, hello, what, where is that power and where is that leadership? Because they've lived, I don't know.
They've lived in their own bubble. They've lived in a bubble, a curated version of themselves in a very linear or one-dimensional space. And that's, for me, I hear you. Social media is unfortunately very asymmetrical when it comes to understanding human potential. So you take that person who might have a million followers on Twitter, who says great things, curated posts, put them in, like you said, the hot seat, and they actually showcase their level of or capacity of where they really are. That's why I think it's important to have understandings of those different types of movements in life from that perspective of mindset, emotional stability, even your spiritual life. Mm-hmm. What really translates into that power you personally possess, and how does that parlay into your leadership? Even if your leadership is social media, directing one person, or running TV show choreography for different types of artists and, like, you know, actors. So, but the other part that I want to tap into quickly too, that's keeps coming up for me, is how, when you're stuck in that kind of place where you're in a bubble and you have people that project expectation on you and you showcase your best life through social media, you end up with the third topic that I brought up earlier, was death, and how that unfortunately tends to be where people's personal demons start to showcase their leadership in that vacuum where they might be lacking all those different elements of their own. So you and I talked about it on that vortex in Sedona about your friend Twitch. He was somebody we ended up chatting about, how unfortunately he was such a happy guy with his family, but behind the scenes, there was something there that was still eating away at him. And that's, I think, another thing that happens with a lot of people in these positions of spotlight and leadership, is they don't know what to do with those personal demons, and they don't know what to deal with. How do we dance with them and how to find the solutions to lead themselves out of it? And unfortunately, things like that tend to happen. So what are your thoughts on when it comes to embracing and understanding our ability to lead ourselves through life and dance through life so that we don't end up in those types of positions that your friend ended up in?
Yeah. And we had only had the opportunity to work together a few times. And he's definitely more of a colleague than his friends. I think his close friends would have insight that I definitely don't have. But what I know from a fact, you know, as a fact, is everyone adored him. And through moments that I learned in his service that I was able to attend, which was like a little bit more of an open service. He had friends and family. So just to clarify that, I hold friendships so dear, you know what I mean? And so
yeah, I do.
Had some friends who would, I learned that he would check in on people all the time, and he would follow up with people and call on them to be honest with what they're feeling and what they're going through. And, you know, perhaps maybe mirroring what he wanted back in return. But I think people probably assumed that he was fine, and he had a very, very deep well that replenished often, and perhaps he gave what he needed. And I think I remember talking a little bit that the social media of it all, the pandemic of it all,
yeah.
The access to home and how within a click people can access your personal life. And then you welcome it because you're getting more from it. There's the more and more of life and more of the internet and streaming and the content, like everything's content, I think is super crippling. Like
right.
The time that I accidentally lose my phone, which probably means it's in the bottom of my car and I just didn't want to look for it. My mom and I were talking about this, is like, I'm happier if I listen to a book, read a book, quote unquote, versus scroll mindlessly, because something in my brain is more fulfilled and it feels better for me. But even right. though, I mean, podcasts too, I love podcasts, don't get me wrong, but there's still a consumption. There's still a what's next when it's done. Like the binging of Netflix and all of that is like, are you still watching what's next? I'm like, when 5-10 years ago, would you ever think that somebody watching 4 hours or 7 hours of TV was healthy? You'd what? Be like, dude, you need to get a life. Like, go outside, read a book, do something, call your friend back.
Yeah.
But
that's what, I mean, we both grew up in that same era where you didn't know who was on the phone until you picked it up. You didn't. Exactly. You know what I mean? It was on the wall. And if you were busy with family, you didn't touch that phone. There was no picking it up.
And
same
then if
thing in relationships.
Somebody else would listen. Like, get off the phone.
Get off the phone. Exactly. You didn't have. And then, of course, if you wanted to go play with friends or have that kind of intimate connection, you left on your bike or skateboard or whatever your tool was. And you went to your neighbor's house and knocked on the door. And you, whether or not they were or weren't available. And you just lived. And honestly, there was so much more peace during those times, I think. And now, like you brought it up with Twitch and other people like him, there's so much projection, there's so much expectation, it's so easy for people to access all of this type of binge content. They're overwhelming themselves, and mm-hmm. they might be the happiest person to other people, but it can cause serious voids, vacuums in someone's life regardless. And then if we don't find, again, the right type of balance and containment, the right type of movement with it, we can end up falling off the deep end and having people. And the thing is about guys like him, and I talked to someone else that knew him too, is nobody asks those that seem strong if they need help. It's always when you feel or come across as confident, strong, a leader, you're the last person anybody's going to go, hey, how are you doing? Do you need any help? Is there anything I can add to your life? Is there anything I can do to help uplift what you're all about? Nobody does that.
Well, and even if they do, I mean, I find that I'm like pretty gregarious and like definitely an extrovert. And when I'm talking and when I'm engaged, I'm really happy. But I can also be like, if someone were to ask me, I'd be like, yeah, it's fine. This and that, but whatever. Yeah, you know, like I'd make a joke out of it and still be happy and be like, such is life. Or my grandma always said, like, no use crying over spilled milk or c'est la vie or whatever. And you move on, because I'm also like, well, you're either working through something with the person you're living life with and you move past it. Or you're just complaining, and there's like a, do you want to fix it, or do you want me to listen? There's a lot of levels to that, and I don't know. I don't want to say that social media and overworking contributes to unhappiness, but I do think it does.
And I agree.
Like, and even like with my friends that have podcasts, like some of my best friends have podcasts, and I'll like ask them what's going on or whatever or how they are, and they're like, did you not listen to the podcast? I'm like, no, I'm sorry, I'm your friend, and I'm asking.
Yeah, why?
Why
would I listen to the podcast and know what's going on with you?
Right, and if it's like, if you worked through something, meaning you talked about it with listeners and fans, that doesn't mean you're working through it with your friends. And I think it's a tricky line with like, celebrating successes. Well, death and massive wins are a very popular topic on social media. If you post anything tragic, you're probably going to get a lot of engagement. If you post, I mean, for me, the Emmys, I was like, well, ironically, the day I the day I won my first Emmy, I woke up on the couch recovering from, I had my fibroids removed and I deal with crazy lady pain. That's anyways, debilitating so much to where I got my fibroids removed. Didn't help, not endometriosis in case anyone's asking. I don't know what it is, but whatever. But when it hits me, it's like a contraction for 30 minutes and like a pain scale of 10 and then happens sometimes up 10 times a day, whatever. So I woke up with laughing like so much it hurt and celebrating, and my friend brought me a Get Well, actually one of my favorite podcasts and friends, her name's Allie Ward. It's called Ologies is her podcast, podcast to podcast plug, I guess. And it's she has a she brought me a Get Well and a congratulations balloon. And the woman at Gelson's was like, I'm so sorry, is this for the same person? She's like, yeah, it's a lot, but yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah, don't worry about it. We'll take care
of it. I kind of love that that happened in the way it did, because that is very, and like when people were probably celebrating me online and being like, I never posted what I was actually doing, that I was like recovering from surgery and in a lot of pain. I just, people probably thought, or, you know, I was on top of the world and not a care in the world, but I was actually in pain.
Yeah. I like though that you don't. I think that's another piece of, and I'm going to touch all these three points, is like dancing, you know, dogs and the, all of it's about discipline and understanding, you know, your, where you should and shouldn't, or maybe how you flow, how you move through the story of life. I like that you don't. I think people nowadays air too much of their own personal grievances on social media as well. And I think it opens up the gateway for other things that we don't really want or need in our lives. And I think there's so much projection and so much that comes at us that if you're dealing with something like what you just shared, you know, vulnerably to us, telling people about it all over the place really doesn't, I don't think it supports your ability to elegantly keep moving through what you're going through. I think it gives you the space and the containment to manage and deal with it. And while, right. I mean, I guess what I'm going back to the point is, even though in the work that I do is battling and slaying personal demons is a huge thing for people of power and influence and success, because there's so much of that, again, that dysfunction or asymmetrical approach to their public persona. They're giving so much that people, millions of people are like, yelling and screaming and arguing and projecting and all of that, and they're taking all that on, and they don't realize that does have an influence and an effect on our lives behind the scenes, who we really are. We can be the happiest people, but it eventually can wear us down. And I think that's why I'm glad you shared that. I think people need to hear that.
Well, also selfishly, then if I said I was sick, I'd have to respond to everyone that was wishing me well and giving me advice,
right?
And then I would have been exhausted from just responding to everybody,
right?
In reality, my mom was there. My friends checked in on me. So I'm good. You know, and then at a certain point I can talk about it when I'm not actively in pain,
right.
You know?
Right. Yep.
I think the irony of like, I don't know. I think the irony of being like, I'm exhausted, I have no time for myself, or I feel crappy about myself, and then having the world then tell you how great you are. I'm like, well, you might've missed the opportunity to like, just, I don't know, go somewhere with your friends and like maybe try to find joy in the silence with your two giant dogs or something.
Yeah. You travel somewhere with them, et cetera. I mean, that's the balance I think that is missing. I think that's the rigidity of life where people are not, again, I think that's what, and I'm just tying things in here, Kat. I think that's what happens with why we've gone from what you are into, which is that story driven comedy based, you know, levity type movement dance in life, and you really express and you enjoy that's who you are in your soul, to this more erratic version of what people think dancing is, you know, the clubs and in the, you know, the nightlife, right, etc. Because people are not giving themselves enough space to do those types of things. It's all about a story on a social media platform now. It's all about exposing oneself, where the truth is, if you're living your best life, you don't really need to post about it. And if you're having a bad time in your life, you shouldn't post about it either. Maybe letting the people that are closest to you support you while you're going through it. And then if someone tends to ask, you might be able to share an experience later. And I think that bringing us back to the discipline aspect from dancing dogs and death, realizing that, again, it's crazy how it all kind of ties together too, and how it parlays into how we can optimize our experiences personally if we're willing to learn how to be a little bit more fluid in our leadership and our discipline and our ability to determine, like you said, with your pups, let me do the due diligence. Should I be doing this right now? Should I express this on Twitter? Should I go share this with this group over here? Maybe that's not the right environment for me to talk about X, and maybe I need to only talk about Y. And if somebody asks me about X, then I can pull them aside, or we just let it all rip. And then we wonder why we don't, there's less freedom in this uncontained environment than there is in a more contained type disciplined environment. Well, I think that's
interesting. You mentioned advice and dogs and what to share and what not to share. To be honest, my dogs are so cute and all I want to do is show pictures of them. I had one comment about my dog on my main page that set me in a spiral, and I was really busy working, very overextended, and this one mean comment of how dare you to me, of like just judgment, and I was like, I don't know what to say back. I was asking my trainer, I'm like, am I doing something wrong? I just couldn't handle it. And my friends are like, put your dogs online. I'm like, oh, I don't think I can handle it. Like, I think, because all I'm trying is the best. I don't want people to get them like wrong idea and think you should definitely have two German Shepherd, Belgian Malinois as pets that are the same age. And then I don't want to deal with the criticism of it's good or bad. Or I also don't want to, I'm also not a trainer or an expert. And I don't, if I'm posting things about what I like to do, then I can't deal with the criticism. And so for me and my dogs, there might be 1,000, these are so cute, or holy cow, you are amazing. But if there's a few that question my method, I know I will let it take over my day and my thoughts at least a week.
I love that you said that. I think that's what happens on a greater scale for some people that end up on that more extreme side of life, where they end up doing things like taking their own life. I think they take too much of that criticism in, and there's not enough of understanding that, hey, you're going to do what you're going to do because that's who you are. You are a leader in your life. You command, you live through that movement. Some people are not going to like that. And I think the more good you do in the world, the more good and righteous work that you are all about, just it doesn't matter what industry or what job, I think doing good, you're going to develop more enemies than you are friends. You're going to have, there's always going to be people that are going to give you the dumbest things. They're going to say, I was on a podcast once that the comments on YouTube were, it's like, this guy's forehead is huge. And like, really, that's what you took away from the 2.5 hour show that I was literally talking about when it comes to human performance. But hey, some people are going to say things like that. And all you can do is, you know what? I don't need to pay attention to them because they have zero relevance to the effectiveness of who I am and how I live and operate in my life. Mm-hmm. And I want people to hear that. It's like, what kind of criticism are you paying attention to? You have a trainer for your dogs for a reason. You didn't hire the guy, Joe Blow on YouTube to help you train your dog. So his comments may not.
How did you know? How did you know his name was Joe Blow? Damn.
Well, that's the point of, I think we're tying it all together here, Kat, comes down to focusing on your capacity of leadership, being clear and having the clarity of what you're leading, how you're leading it, what power means to you, what you should and shouldn't share. Again, fine-tuning your ability, going back to whiskey tasting, slowing down, finding the story in your life and dancing with it, moving in a way that satisfies the passion in your heart, getting people around you. And you don't have to answer everybody's asks or thoughts or criticisms, but you can at the same time find a way in which you can leash it, contain it. And the same thing goes, I want people to get back to disciplining their children differently. I want them so that, I mean, when we grew up, the stuff you see on social media, there's no way I acted like that way in a restaurant. You can't even get a right hook. It'd be game over.
There's so many like methods and books now, like my friends that will like name a thing. And the second you name the thing, that's either right or wrong. There's like not an intuitive mothering anymore.
Absolutely.
Parenting.
Go ahead.
No. I'm just saying it's like there's a right or wrong now versus like there's pictures and this is definitely wrong. Seatbelts have saved lives, that we all know. But when my mom and dad took videos of all of us growing up and when we were born and then I was born in 1980 and my sister was born in 1970. So to see the difference, my mom was pissed that in 1980 she had to be wheelchaired to the car, even though she had no pain in labor. And it was like I was sitting on a nerve or something strange and like had the most painful labor of all time. I'm not exaggerating, which is...
Yeah, times have changed. I remember riding station wagons with no seatbelts. I completely understand that.
The video was all my siblings standing on the bench seats, like looking at me as my mom held me, but she had to sit in the back seat and she was so annoyed.
Yeah, and you know, that's the thing is, times do change. People do change. Things change. And we need to be able to, and I'm going back to the beginning here, we need to be able to dance with it. I think if we start bringing people back to learning how to actually... not even just metaphorically, even literally, learning how to dance differently, learning how to appreciate that movement in life changes the way we react to life itself. And it actually can help support our ability to find discipline and more meaning in the things we do, like raising children, raising dogs, being successful, what it is we care about or are passionate about in life, it can change the landscape of our own ability to experience life the way that we say we want it to be, rather than based on what everybody else thinks we should. So,
exactly.
I mean, drawing to the end here, Kat. I hate it. I could go for hours with you. Maybe we'll have to do it again. But yeah. Are there any other like wise words that you can think of right now that really would help people that are listening to you and your story you shared on the story-driven movement, how to bring them back to the place of appreciating less rigid aspects of living?
Well, I was just thinking, not something I'd pre-planned or anything, but when you were talking, it's like if growing up in, well, Texas, but my middle school age and younger was in LA. And yeah. My dad, you know, being like in these tall buildings for work, was saying that he lived in they built an earthquake-proof building, like a 30-plus whatever-foot skyscraper. And that meant is it swayed whenever there was an earthquake versus being rigid and still. Because if it was rigid and still and there was an earthquake, it would crumble. But when it moved with the ground moving, when it moved with the movement versus trying to fight it, it saved the structure of the building, which is interesting if you think about people. And then you also hear stories, or wives' tale or not, but wives' tale. Why are they called wives' tales? They should be called husband tales. But anyways,
that's a good point.
It's not wives, but anyways.
It's men.
Wives' tales, whatever it is.
Wives' tale, but it is men.
whenever there's a car accident, speaking of seatbelts, you've heard if someone was drunk, they're more likely to survive the tumble because their bodies are flowing with it. They're moving with it.
Same with bull riding. I mean, rodeo, I had a buddy of mine, we were riding, and he got knocked out on the side. He was falling off the side. He got caught up in his rope, got knocked out. Because he was a rag doll, he didn't break any bones. I mean, he was bruised up. No bones.
Wow.
His body completely took it. So I love that we're ending here on that note, and how it's really about, truly, it is about dancing with life. I mean, the building dances with the earthquake. You're right. I'm from California, too. And it's like being in a building that can move with it. If you learn how to shake and move with life rather than try to fight up against it, you'll find that things tend to work out a little bit better for you. And you start to learn a little bit more about your capacity to succeed in a way that you never thought was possible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. Kat, it's been absolutely a pleasure. I'm hoping we can do it again down the road, because I really think there's so much more value in the wise words that you possess that we can unpack together. But thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate you doing this with me.
Thank you. And what a kismet moment on top of
it. Yes, it is. It is. I'm really glad we met, and I'm looking forward to our ongoing connection. But before we go, I want to make sure that people know in the audience that if you want to try whiskey or you want to win yourself a bottle of whiskey, I'm doing a whiskey giveaway every month for the rest of the year. The link to that giveaway will be provided in the show description. So you can enter, click the link, follow the instructions. You'll be put into the drawing. And if you win, I will be contacting you personally through email. Other than that, I hope you enjoyed the conversation between Kat and I. If you would like and subscribe to the podcast, I would really appreciate that. It would help me bring on other great guests like Kat. And if you want to leave a comment or a suggestion for a guest, please do so as well wherever you listen to podcasts. I appreciate everybody hanging out with us as well. Kat, again, such a pleasure to see your face. Thank you so much for all the wise words you shared. And until next time, I hope you join us again. Cheers.
Cheers. Thank you so much for having me.